Good morning. I'm Mike Nichols with NBAA. It's my pleasure to welcome you to the first educational session of this regional forum at Spirit of St. Louis Airport. Hopefully everybody's had a chance to get around and see some of the aircraft and some of the exhibits, and I'm glad you're here for this program. This is obviously an important issue for many folks within business aviation. The topic is non-business use of business aircraft, and I'm pleased that we have Joanne Barbera with the firm of Cooling and Herbers in Kansas City, Missouri. She's a shareholder there. To present on this topic. Joanne is probably one of the best people to present on this topic, not only because she's extremely knowledgeable about it, but she's also extremely current on this. Joanne is the incoming chair of our tax committee at NBAA, and in that capacity, she has participated in several meetings that we've had with the IRS and the Department of Treasury on this topic. So she has some relevant and current information that she'll share throughout her presentation, as well as the technical information related to the FAA and IRS and the SEC. So with that, I'll turn it over to Joanne, and there will be lots of opportunities for questions and answers at the end of her presentation. I will have a wireless microphone, and what I do ask is if you have a question, hold your hand up and wait until I have a microphone for you to ask the question. Thank you very much. Joanne?
Thank you, Mike, and good morning, everyone. It's good to see you. One thing that you may ask at the very beginning of the presentation is, why in the world am I talking about non-business use of business aircraft? We're here for business, right? Well, this is a topic that is very timely, and it's kind of the tail wagging the dog right now, I think, in the industry from a regulatory and tax standpoint. So I want to talk about why that is and some of the things that you need to think about if you have any non-business use of your business aircraft. In the current environment, many companies permit non-business aircraft by executives, directors, or substantial shareholders. There are many reasons for this, including good business reasons for security, convenience, comfort, and efficiency to the executive or other person, and also because the company maintains prompt communications with the executive or other person and that they can talk confidentially with their colleagues on board the aircraft, which cannot be done really on commercial aircraft. From a regulatory standpoint, non-business use of the business aircraft does bring up some regulatory issues. If you're operating Part 91, which is the general operating rules of the Federal Aviation Regulations, the FAA says that personal use of the company aircraft is permitted, but executives cannot reimburse the company for non-business use. And there's actually a chief counsel, an FAA chief counsel opinion on this. It's Charles A. Schwab, and it was issued several years ago. And they said that Charles A. Schwab himself could not reimburse Charles A. Schwab and company for personal use of the company aircraft. And I think they gave an example of a vacation flight, because that use was not within the scope of and incidental to the business of Charles A. Schwab, the company. So no reimbursement was allowed under Federal Aviation Regulation 91501, which is the regulation that most companies operate under to receive reimbursement, a cost-based reimbursement of some expenses. The FAA has been recently informally asked if they would reconsider the Schwab opinion, and they still think that it was a good opinion, even though I think there are still very good business reasons for allowing an executive or other individual to use a company aircraft personally in certain circumstances. But the FAA feels that they got it right, and they still should not permit reimbursement under this general cost reimbursement rule. So what does a company do if they do have some personal use of the company aircraft? There are a few methods for a Part 91 operator to receive reimbursement for such use. One type of reimbursement arrangement would be time sharing. This is under Federal Aviation Regulation 91501. Now, just to step aside a little bit and talk about Federal Aviation Regulation 91501 a little bit, it's in subpart F of Part 91, and that's for large and turbine-powered aircraft. So if you have, for example, a smaller King Air or some other turboprop aircraft, you don't automatically fall into these reimbursement rules of 91501, but you can, through NBAA membership, receive the benefit of the NBAA members' small aircraft exemption, and that allows you to follow the procedures in the exemption and to operate the aircraft for reimbursement like the larger aircraft can do. So under this 91501, you can do time sharing, which is basically a lease of the aircraft to the individual with crew for limited reimbursement. Reimbursement is basically limited to 2 times the cost of fuel for the particular flights involved, plus a few other reimbursable expenses. You could also dry lease the aircraft to the executives. A dry lease is a lease of the aircraft without crew. The executive has to hire crew separately, and the crew cannot come from the same source as the aircraft. And then the executive is then in operational control of the aircraft for that flight. If the aircraft is on a charter certificate, you could certainly have the executive charter the company's aircraft, which is a possibility, or you could have the company charter another aircraft for the executive's use, or the executive can charter another aircraft for his use. So charter does allow some more flexibility for reimbursement in the personal use situations. And oftentimes, as we go through the tax rules a little bit more, sometimes you find that it's more tax advantageous for the executive to charter another aircraft for particular flights. Under Part 91, Subpart K, which is the section of the regulations that deals with the fractional ownership of aircraft, for fractional ownership, some companies, to take care of that personal use of the aircraft, to do purchase a fractional share that the executive can use for that use, or the executive himself oftentimes purchases a fractional share to deal with that type of use. I just want to do a federal excise tax note. If there's any reimbursement coming from the executive for the use of the aircraft, then that's generally federal excise taxable. Now, there is an exemption for small aircraft. That's aircraft under 6,000 pounds. So the IRS FET definition of small aircraft is different from the FAA definition of small aircraft, which is 12,500 pounds. Under 12,500 pounds. So the issue here is that federal excise tax is a 7.5% tax on the amount paid for transportation plus a per-person segment fee. And so if there's reimbursement under a time-sharing agreement or 135, you're going to look for federal excise tax to apply to that. For a dry lease, however, which is the lease of the aircraft without crew, there would not be federal excise tax if the crew and the aircraft truly come from separate sources. Now, we get more into the tax rules now, because the tax rules in many ways are driving this issue these days. And I'm going to start out with the tax rules that still apply and have been in place for quite a long time. These are the fringe benefit rules that says that if a company provides aircraft usage for the executive or employee's personal purposes, that that's a fringe benefit to that employee, and the value of that fringe benefit needs to be either reimbursed by the executive or employee or has to be included in that person's income. And so the IRS doesn't differentiate between reimbursement and imputing income to the person. They just say that value needs to be recognized and accounted for somehow as between the company and the employee or shareholder or other person. So the IRS does not follow Schwab in the no reimbursement rule. Non-business use, as I said, does create compensation to executives who are not allowed to reimburse or cannot or do not reimburse. And that compensation is imputed on their W-2 or 1099 to the extent the company's not reimbursed. Their next question that comes up is, what is the value of that personal use of the company aircraft? And there are 2 rules under the fringe benefit rules. There's a general valuation rule that would basically have you use the charter flight value for a particular flight on the aircraft. There's also a standard industry fare level, a special valuation rule based on first class airfare that you can use and is what most companies use and most individuals use to value this personal use. And all of this is found in Treasury Regulation 1.61-21. G is where you find the special valuation rules for business aircraft. Just to talk a little bit more about these fringe benefit rules, they apply to personal flights by all employees. There's a broad definition of employees, so many times where you have an independent contractor that provides services for the company and is receiving some personal use of the company aircraft, they too would be pulled into these fringe benefit rules. Personal is very broad as well. It means all flights not on the business of the company providing the transportation. It does not, the valuation itself does not include deadhead flights. So if you have a personal flight by an individual, an employee, that goes from St. Louis to New York, and then the aircraft deadheads back to St. Louis, that deadhead flight is not, that value of that deadhead flight is not included in the employee's income, only the value of the flight that the passengers were carried on. There are also special civil rules for control employees, which are basically your officers, directors, and most highly compensated individuals, and non-control employees, who's everybody else. There are special rates available under the standard industry fare level or special valuation rules for bona fide business-oriented security plans. If you have that in place, you get a little bit better income result to the executive. And also, if at least half, at least 50% of the passenger seats on the aircraft are filled with business passengers, a narrow category of employees and their dependents and spouses are included at a zero valuation rate under the special valuation rules. So all of these are rules that if any of you work through the accounting on this or the tax return on this, you see these rules and very familiar with them. The IRS also has another set of rules that come to play with non-business use of business aircraft. And on the fringe benefit side, we are talking about the income to the employee, the compensation factor to the employee. On the entertainment rules side, this is Internal Revenue Code Section 274, we're talking about the company itself, the taxpayer, their deductions for a business aircraft, so their income tax deductions. Under old law, there was a case called Sutherland Lumber, under that case, the court allowed full deductions for entertainment use of company aircraft that was properly treated as a fringe benefit under the compensation rules, the fringe benefit rules that we just talked about. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on which side you are on this topic, the American Jobs Creation Act of 2004 changed all that. It specifically overturned Sutherland Lumber. It amends Internal Revenue Code Section 274E to specifically deal with the situation. And the result is that it limits company expense deductions for use of a business aircraft by a specified individual, and it defines a specified individual with respect to the SEC rules, and that is basically an officer, director, or more than 10% owner, for an activity generally considered to be entertainment, amusement, or recreation to the amount included as compensation to the individual. So under the Sutherland Lumber case, you had a situation where there was vacation flights by the company owners, who were also executives in the company. And those vacation flights were treated as compensation to those executives. And the company did not lose any tax deductions. The aircraft was fully deductible as a business asset, and all expenses, even the expenses directly related to that vacation use, because they treated, on the fringe benefit side, the compensation to the executives properly. under the American Jobs Creation Act, they said no, the company should lose tax deductions because the tax deductions is for property and expenses for the trader business. And we think that that vacation use and other entertainment use of the company aircraft is not consistent with that trader business use. And under 274, which specifically talks about entertainment use of property, entertainment expenses incurred by business for entertainment of its employees or executives, we think that there should be loss of disallowance, some disallowance of tax deductions, some loss of tax deductions for that. The American Jobs Creation Act rule itself was pretty short. It just said basically 274E, they added some additional words, and specifically in the commentary to the legislation talked about overturning Sutherland's. But this is a very complex area. 274 has been around for a long time, and there were a lot of questions following the legislation. So in May of 2005, which was pretty quickly after the statute came into play, the IRS provided their guidance. They released Notice 2005-45, and again, it provides interim guidance to comply with Section 274 until the regulations are effective. And it applies to all expenses incurred after June 30th, 2005. For those expenses incurred with respect to entertainment use of the company aircraft by specified individuals between, October 24th, 2004 and June 30th, 2005, you can use any reasonable method of computing the disallowance there. So under the notice, it applies a disallowance to all aircraft fixed and variable costs, including depreciation. So in determining what expenses are disallowed, you have to look at the whole realm of expenses related to that aircraft. Hangar, depreciation, all of your fixed costs, the pilot salaries, the fuel and other direct operating costs. And so they said one of the questions early on was, is it just variable costs or do you look at all the costs? And the IRS said, no, you look at all the costs. They also decided to allocate costs on a per passenger occupied seat hour or mile basis and not on a flight-by-flight basis. And the example of that is that if you have a CEO and spouse, assuming the spouse is not an employee and not on the company business, fly to the CEO's business meeting. If that's your only flight for the whole year, you would have a 50% disallowance based on that one flight because they count each seat on the aircraft as an entertainment use of equivalent value, basically. So I've been sort of laughing within the industry. You know, we have a lot of pilots here probably and a lot of people on the operations side where a flight of the aircraft is the entire aircraft moving from point A to point B. The IRS view of a flight on the aircraft for purposes of this rule is a butt in a seat, basically, moving from point A to point B. So each seat gets a different, each occupied seat gets their own an equal value. So there's basically, they then do a math calculation of allocating expenses to flights. You determine your occupied seat hours or miles for each passenger for each trip and allocate deadhead hours. You then aggregate all fixed and variable expenses for the taxable year. You divide the total expenses by the total occupied seat hours or miles to determine the cost per occupied seat hour or mile. And you can do this on a fleet basis. If you have aircraft of similar cost profiles, you can aggregate them, or you can do it on a per aircraft basis. Then you look at it and you say the cost, you determine a cost of each occupied seat hour or mile flown by a specified individual. And you take the cost of all occupied seat hour or miles flown by a specified individual for entertainment purposes. You offset it with the compensation, that person was recognized over on the fringe benefit side, and the remainder is disallowed for purposes of 274. Now, I talk a little bit here about the 162 limitation for covered employees. You don't get that compensation offset, or that compensation offset is limited to the extent that you've got a covered employee that would be in a public company, the chief executive officer, for example, who's making over $1 million of compensation that's covered in that 162M limitation. So just something to be aware of there. Just a few more things about this IRS Notice 2005-45. It applies to entertainment flights by specified individuals. Specified individuals are, again, officers, directors, and beneficial owners of more than 10% of any class of equity security. It includes their family members and guests. And it includes a specified individual of a related party. So if you have two related companies and the CEO of Company A flies on Company B's aircraft, they're still going to be treated as a specified individual of Company B because the two parties are related. There's an objective test for entertainment, amusement, or recreation, and it's probably narrower than the fringe benefit rules personal. So you can come up with this odd situation where over here on the fringe benefit compensation side, you've got, for example, charity flights by the executive on the company aircraft are not on the business of the company. And so you may end up with a situation where you have compensation to the individual for those flights. Or another good example are outside board meetings that are not related to the business of the company providing the aircraft. But is an outside board meeting entertainment? I think by most objective standards, you would not consider an outside board meeting entertainment. So there are situations where the individual will receive fringe benefit compensation under the fringe benefit rules, but that flight should not count as an entertainment flight over on the 274 disallowance calculations. There are also special rules for deadhead flights. In my example, where we've got a flight, let's say there's one specified individual on board for entertainment purposes from St. Louis to New York, and then the aircraft deadheads back. For the fringe benefit rules, you're only going to give compensation to that individual for the flight out to New York, but not the deadhead flight back. Under the entertainment rules, however, you treat the aircraft coming back as if that same individual for that same purpose was on board, and so that there's some disallowance of expenses for the deadhead flight back as well. And they specifically said in the notice that even if the executive is under a security plan, meaning the company has conducted a security study and determined that for the safety of the executive, it's necessary for him to use the company aircraft for all flights or a certain profile of flights, that doesn't matter for the entertainment use rules. You still apply the same disallowance deduction. The same disallowance calculations as if there was no security plan in place. There are new developments on this. This entertainment use of company aircraft is an identified audit priority related to executive fringe benefits. It's been in the papers for several years these high executives, they make a lot of money, they get a lot of perks, and I know there have been in Fortune and in the Wall Street Journal and a lot of other publications articles about that. And so the IRS, in their audit guide, have kind of cited some of these articles and said to the IRS agents, not only do you need to audit on this, but here, look at these articles on what's been going on and get mad about it. The other thing is that the IRS has been working on regulations for quite some time to give us more of an idea of how the entertainment disallowance rules work. There's still a lot of open questions even after Notice 2005-45, and there were a lot of comments to that notice as well. And so the NBAA Tax Committee has been meeting with IRS periodically over the last several years, and in our latest meeting with both the IRS and Treasury, it sounds like the regulations, the IRS thinks they're all drafted. We don't know if that's the version that will come out. Treasury would like to have them out by the end of this month. I very frantically looked on my BlackBerry on the tax news this morning, trying to read that on a small screen. I didn't see anything come out yet today, but really we're holding our breath and thinking any day now. Once the regulations come out, we're not sure whether there'll be proposed regulations again or whether there's going to be some sort of final rule in there, and we'll have to look at timing and whatever the new rules are as well. So basically, the consequences of the Job Act were that there was a backdoor major tax increase on companies that permit non-business use of business aircraft. We've had NBA members say that they've had tax increases of $940,000 or $2 million a year, depending on the budget of the company. If there's a security plan in place, the company is kind of caught in a catch-22 because the executive is required to use the company aircraft for all travel, but yet the company is suffering disallowance for that under the entertainment rules as if there were no business security issue at all. The tax benefits of business ownership and operation have been drastically affected by this. And we've seen several situations where a company aircraft, and in this case I think it was a G4, traveled regularly from coast to coast, but on business flights they had one or two passengers on board, and the business flights were really the bulk of the flights, but the CEO had a large family, and when he went on vacation with his family, he loaded all the seats up. And what it turned what was on a flight-by-flight basis, 75% business use aircraft, 25% non-business use aircraft, to a 25 business use aircraft and 75% personal use aircraft, just because of the IRS rules that count every seat the same. And so ever since the Jobs Act and the notice came out, the big question is, how do we mitigate the effects of this? The biggest effect, I think, or the most immediate effect, was that the record-keeping burden for aircraft owners and operators increased substantially. Everyone kept logbooks of each flight of the aircraft, but many times those logs did not track each passenger on the aircraft, and certainly did not track each passenger's purpose for being on the aircraft. And that is all necessary now to comply with these IRS rules. And then somebody at the end has to analyze all that data. So we've sort of joking among the tax committee, because you got to find some humor in all this, that this was the Accountants Jobs Creation Act, not just the American Jobs Creation Act. There's a lot of looking at what the purpose of the use is particularly, and that not all personal use is entertainment use. It has had the effect, and I think this was a desired effect by Congress, is to reduce entertainment use of business aircraft by specified individuals. That's certainly happening. You can also increase business passengers and business use, and this is something that I think NBAA is trying to encourage because they are business aircraft, and to the extent that you get more business use out of your business aircraft, that's good for the whole industry. A lot of aircraft owners and operators that have more than one aircraft in their fleet should look each year to see whether they get a better profile or a better result, depending on whether they aggregate their aircraft into a fleet or whether they treat each aircraft separately. And this is a situation where if you have a newer aircraft that you still have a lot of depreciation deductions left on, the aircraft cost profile for that aircraft at least in tax terms, you have a lot bigger numbers than your older, fully depreciated aircraft, because depreciation is by far the largest tax cost item associated with the aircraft. And so sometimes if you can do your entertainment use on the older, fully depreciated aircraft, that's a way to mitigate the effects of this Job Creation Act and the notice. Or if the individual involved or the individuals involved insist on taking the new aircraft, if you aggregate the two, then you can kind of spread out the costs a little bit. And then there are plenty of companies who have said, look, we're not going to use our new business jet for entertainment use anymore. We're going to charter another aircraft or use a fractional share for entertainment use, or have the executive purchase that charter or purchase that fractional share him or herself. There are also developments in this area for public companies who are required by the SEC to report clear, concise, and understandable reporting of executive and director compensation. This is in the regulations SK. There was a new rule on this adopted in July of last year. Aircraft personal use for a long time has been in the category of a perk or a perquisite, reportable as other compensation on the compensation table of the proxy statement and other reports. The SEC measure, of course, is not the same as the FAA or the IRS fringe benefit or the IRS entertainment use. It's yet another cost amount, and they use aggregate incremental cost. The current reporting threshold for other compensation for executives that show up on that executive compensation table is $10,000. So if you have an aggregate of other compensation in a particular year over $10,000, then you've got to itemize every single cost, every single perk under that, and explain that perk. There is also now a compensation discussion and analysis section of the SEC reporting, and there is also now a director's compensation table as well. One of the things that has been brought up all this time is if you're chartering an aircraft to an executive or timesharing an aircraft to an executive, leasing an aircraft to or from an executive, that may be a related party transaction, and there's separate related party transaction reporting, and the threshold for that is now for items that are over $120,000 per year. Compensation arrangements are required to be disclosed, and also we're finding that timesharing agreements or certain timesharing agreements are considered material agreements and are subject to the very quick turnaround of 8K reporting. The SEC has had enforcement cases on specifically on the perquisite of personal use of the company aircraft. There was an old case called W.R. Grace where there was basically a slap on the wrist. GE's Jack Welch, in his severance or retirement package, he had quite a bit of personal use of the company aircraft, and that was the subject of a enforcement action and consent order. And then Tyson Foods actually had a fine associated with their consent on that. And then there's a case been going on in the federal district court in Kansas that I don't know if anybody here has been following, but it was a couple of executives of Westar Energy, which is a big company out of Topeka. And it's actually a federal criminal fraud trial. And one of the big items that was discussed in that trial was the use of the company aircraft and the personal use of the company aircraft there. So it can have very public and very serious consequences if it's not treated correctly. So again, just to kind of rehash a little bit on this, you have under the SEC rules, there's disclosure for top executives and directors perks. A perk is all non-business flights. Again, we're in the broader category of business versus non-business. Aggregate incremental cost includes deadheads, unlike And this, actually, this deadhead guidance was in a speech by the SEC back in September of last year. So I know I've had the question recently, well, how do we know we have to include deadheads in this aggregate incremental cost? There was actually a speech on it where the director of this area in the SEC said that it should be included. So that's been taken as guidance on that. And again, on the SEC side, there's no exception provided for flights made under a security plan. A couple of other areas to cover a little bit or consider with respect to non-business use of business aircraft. Internal Revenue Code Section 409A talks about deferred compensation arrangements and qualified versus non-qualified plans. And for retired executives or retiring executives, you have to look very closely at the benefits provided to that executive after retirement. And it's important to that that you look at any use of the company aircraft provided after that point as well. Also under Sarbanes-Oxley, there's a prohibition of personal loans to executives, which may come up into play if, for example, you have a timesharing arrangement with an executive that the executive is allowed to rack up great charges under the timesharing agreement without actually paying them. That might have personal loan implications. And also Sarbanes-Oxley put into place some audit committee member independence that you need to maybe look at whether any audit committee members are using the aircraft for non-business use. New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ rules also have independent director and committee requirements, corporate governance guidelines, and talk about related party transactions. And then state law can also come into play as far as proper fiduciary duty to the corporation, no corporate waste, those kinds of theories. There are some implications of non-business use, and I want to talk about these a little bit more. Again, from the IRS and fringe benefit situation, you look at whether the valuation is fair market value or CIFL under your company's policy. You generally have to pick one way for all flights, for all employees, and stick with that way. There's a small exception in Notice 2005-45 that for those specified individuals, if they would like to reimburse or be included in compensation at fair market value, you can do that for those individuals' flights. For the IRS, on the entertainment side, you're using the seat hours and seat miles methods. On the SEC side, you have aggregate incremental cost. In the FAA, you've got to ask, is the executive allowed to reimburse and under what type of agreement? So there are lots of different valuations and situations to consider. I have a couple of examples here. And am I running? I think I've still got time. And my example is on May 31st, 2007, the CEO and a spouse travel on the company G4SP from Dallas to San Francisco and back. The CEO is on business, the spouse travel is non-business, no security plans in place. So you start basically to look at the flight. Each flight, and I'm talking about flight of the aircraft, is 1,471.8 statute miles, and it's important that even though for FAA purposes and the flight logs purposes, you're probably using nautical miles, for all tax purposes, you're going to look at this from statute miles. And the conversion factor is there's generally 1.15 statute miles in each nautical mile. So you look at the length of the flight. You use the CIFL rates for the first half of calendar year 2007. This is, again, on the fringe benefits side, that standard industry fare level special valuation rules. Those rates change every 6 months, so you've got to get the right rates, and that's for the first half of calendar year 2007. Each category of aircraft, and this is by weight, has a different multiple to place into this standard industry fare level formula. So a G4 aircraft multiple for a control employee is 400%. And so you do then the calculation. The rate on CIFL, you've got a particular rate for the first 500 miles times 400%. And then you've got your next category rate for the next number of miles. And then you have a terminal charge, and then you've got two flights and a round trip, and so that's $2,135.76 for the spouse. Now, the executives, the CEO, is on business, so there's no valuation for his flight because that's clearly a business flight and it's not compensation to him. It's just the spouse's personal flight. Now, does the spouse get a 1099 for that? No. It goes on the executive's W-2 because that passenger is attributed to him. She's on board because he's on board. There's an easier way to go through this calculation. There's a CIFL calculator on the NBAA website that is very helpful in this area. Just to continue on this same example where we have a CEO on business and spouse non-business, you've got to then look at you've got the IRS fringe benefit rules we just talked about. You've got a CIFL valuation of $2,135.76 to the CEO. You then look at the IRS entertainment rules. And this is an entertainment use by the spouse. Spouse travel, if the spouse is not an employee of the company, is almost always entertainment use. There are special rules in 274 that make it very hard to characterize that use as anything else. So you look then at the company's trade or business deduction with respect to the aircraft, and you're going to have to make some sort of disallowance for the presence of that spouse on the flight. From an SEC standpoint, and one of the very great frustrations about the Notice 2005-45 method for entertainment use disallowance calculations is you don't know until the end of the year what your disallowance is going to be. So if the CEO says on January 2nd, hey, I want to take this trip, I want to bring my, you know, I'm going for business, I'm going to bring my spouse, she's an entertainment use passenger, what's it going to cost me? You can very easily sit down with the CIFL rules and figure out, oh, this means to you fringe benefit income of $2,135.76. Well, is it going to cost the company anything? You don't know till the end of the year what that occupied seat mile or seat hour rate is going to be, so it's very hard to tell an executive what it means to the company to have that extra personal passenger or entertainment passenger for that flight. For SEC purposes, you've just got an additional passenger on a flight that was going where it was going for business anyway. So there's little, if any, aggregate incremental cost for the spouse. But if you reach over that $10,000 threshold, some companies are getting advice from their SEC counsel that they still need to disclose that personal use, even though there's virtually no or exactly no value associated with it. For FAA purposes, if we're assuming FAR Part 91 and there's no time-sharing agreement in effect, then there can be no reimbursement for that. And from an IRS federal excise tax standpoint, if there's no reimbursement, then there's no federal excise tax to apply. So the result is that there's $2,135.76 imputed to the CEO's income for the presence of his spouse for non-business purposes on the flight. And there's going to be some aircraft cost deduction disallowed by the company, but you're not going to know that exact amount till the end of the year. I've got another example where both the CEO and spouse are on the vacation trip, same flight profiles except both passengers are on vacation, and so that's entertainment for both of them. For the IRS fringe benefit rules, basically you double the CIFL valuation because you have two passengers now making the round trip, so the CEO has a CIFL valuation of $4,271.52. It's imputed to the CEO's income if the CEO doesn't pay that amount. For IRS entertainment rule purposes, you've got double the number of occupied seat hours or miles for specified individual entertainment use purposes. So then you have to do your calculations on that. For SEC purposes, you report the aggregate incremental cost. And here I've sort of done an estimate at 7 hours at about $3,100 an hour as the direct operating costs associated with that flight. And it's about 21,000 $784. And then you can offset that with any reimbursement received by the executive. And if you've got a time-sharing agreement, you might want to consider whether you have any disclosure requirements under the related party rules or 8K rules. For Sarbanes-Oxley purposes, if you've got any reimbursement due from the executive, you've got to look into the personal loan issues. And then also you need to have a compliant or prudent policy and comply with it. For New York Stock Exchange, NASDAQ rules, you have the same issues. For FAA purposes, and we're going to assume that this flight is flown Part 91, if the executive is going to reimburse, you need to have a timesharing in place prior to the flight, and you have to follow the timesharing rules. So for a large aircraft such as a G4, you have to have a written agreement between the parties. It needs to be filed with the FAA within 24 hours after execution. You need to give your local FISDO at least 48 hours of notice of the first flight under the timesharing agreement, and you've got a limitation of 2 times the cost of fuel for that particular flight. And so here we've got about $29,000 that is the maximum that can be reimbursed under the timesharing agreement. For IRS federal excise tax purposes, if there's an amount reimbursed by the executive under the timesharing agreement, then it's subject to federal excise tax, and the executive has to pay that as well. And the company's job is then to report and remit that to the IRS. So the result of the vacation flight for both the CEO and the spouse, is if there's no timesharing agreement, then the executive receives $4,271.52 income, and a substantial disallowance of cost deduction is received by the company. And the if they're a public company, then you've got an SEC perk of $21,784 that's going to go on the other compensation column of the executive compensation table of the proxy. If there's a timesharing agreement in place and you use the maximum reimbursement, then for IRS fringe benefit purposes, there's no income on the executive's W-2 for those flights because you've already reimbursed more than the CIFL amount. You then you still need to work through your disallowance issues, and I think for most aircraft cost profiles or for most companies, you would still have some disallowance of expenses associated with that, even though the executive made a substantial reimbursement. For our Sarbanes-Oxley issues, you're going to have to work through those issues. If you've got a public company and SEC reporting, there's probably no perk to report because this $29,000, which is the maximum timesharing rate, is higher in this case than the aggregate incremental cost, which was about $21,000. And so you don't have an SEC perk to report, but you may have to consider that $29,000 payment under the timesharing agreement and report it as a related party transaction. Or report the other and treat the timesharing agreement properly. So, and then you would have federal excise tax to the executive on top of the reimbursement rate. So, the total cost to the executive is about $31,188.60. As you can tell, this is why the tail is wagging the dog. This is a very complex set of rules for what is considered a very incremental use of the aircraft because the personal use by the executive many times occurs on the weekend when the aircraft is not needed for business use or as an extra seat on the aircraft when the CEO is going on a business flight and you've got a spouse, non-employee spouse coming along. So I hope this has been helpful for you all and informative, and I'm ready for questions.
Yeah, I was wondering, do the expense limitations apply when you're chartering through a Part 135 type carrier? If I'm taking 4 people on a business trip and there are a couple extra seats and I have somebody else come along for the ride, are my expenses then impacted as far as the way I can deduct on taxes?
That's a very good question. So you are the charter operator.
No, I would be
the person. Oh, you're the person.
Yeah, I want to charter the aircraft. I've been doing that, and we haven't taken extra people yet, but sometimes we're flying empty seats, and we think, well, if somebody wants to come along, why not? But does that entertainment, will it limit my deduction
Yes.
An expense.
So the scenario is that you have a charter customer chartering an aircraft. Most of the seats are for business purposes, but you've got one or two spouses or other individuals coming along for entertainment purposes. Yes, your cost that you look at is the cost of that charter of the aircraft, and then you do have to look at each individual who's on the board on that charter and their purpose for being on board. And if you've got a specified individual or their spouse or family member or friend riding along for entertainment purposes, there's going to be some disallowance of that charter expense.
In your Gulfstream example,
mm-hmm.
if that was the only flight that year, the fact the wife went along or the spouse, would that potentially reduce their depreciation deduction by half?
Yes. That's 274 and notice 2545.
Can you get that changed for us?
We've been working very hard on that.
Just
to put my NBAA tax committee hat on for a minute, when notice 2005-45 came out, NBAA immediately commented, we urged a change in method of allocation of costs with respect to entertainment use. We urged that only direct costs be used instead of all fixed costs because, frankly, whether the airplane's sitting in the hangar over the weekend or going out on a golf trip, you've got the same depreciation of the aircraft, and so it shouldn't make any difference that you've getting additional utilization out of the aircraft. So we urged a different costs to be included in it, and as well as some exceptions, some de minimis rules, especially because of the record-keeping burden, and we kind of pointed out that the FEA rules are running very counter to this, and so that there should be some exceptions if the executive pays, either under timesharing agreement or pays for a charter, that should accept it from these rules. And we just don't know the outcome of that yet. We'll know when the regulations come out how well received that was.
If you operate the plane under a 135, and mm-hmm. part of the use of the plane is business, part of the use of the plane is under charter, is the seat miles in this, is it the total of the two that you're going to use to calculate the non-business use of the airplane?
That's a good question, a very common question, especially as the dual use, Part 91 and 135 use of aircraft is becoming more and more common. I think the answer is that usually for the charter use, the aircraft owner doesn't have enough information to calculate on the per seat hour or mile method and the purpose of each passenger. You just don't have that information with respect to the charter use. So even though the IRS doesn't specify on how you should treat that, I think the common industry practice has been to look at all your flight hours or miles for the year, determine how much, what percentage of that use is charter versus Part 91 business use or your own business use, kind of carve off that charter percentage both from a cost standpoint as well as an income standpoint and treat that separately. And then the remaining percentage that is the part, basically the business, the owner's use percentage, those are the costs you look at for determining, because you do have a responsibility for gathering all that information about for the per seat hour or per seat mile calculations on that, and so you would treat it to the, let's say it's 25% charter use, 75% owner's use. You would look at the 75% as your costs, and then you would do your allocations based on that.
Hi, these rules do run counter, obviously, to what the FAA requires, because if the aircraft is operated purely under Part 91 and the executive is being imputed income for the carriage of the spouse, then you are forcing the flight department to operate as a illegal 135 charter. They're being compensated for the carriage of a single source. The pilot and the airplane is coming from the same place. So if the FAA catches wind of that, they will lodge a civil penalty action against the corporate flight department.
I think in that, this is one of these areas that we had this conversation ahead of time. You never ask the question of the FAA that you don't exactly want the answer to. And what is developed in practice is that in practice, the companies feel that the better practice is if you're operating Part 91, you don't have a time-sharing agreement or some other method available to have compensation from the executive, that you don't allow them to pay you in money. But you can't get around the IRS rules that require you to impute fringe benefit income to that individual. So rather than having Part 91 be a bar to non-business use altogether, it's more considered in the industry a bar to payment by the executive or compensation from the executive back to the company for that use. And so there's kind of a distinction been built up whether it's technically correct or not that imputing to the executive is probably okay to for Part 91 purposes, but payment by the executive except under a timesharing agreement or dry lease or something like that is not okay. So,
any other questions?
This is not really a question, but could you expound on the spouse privileges, like they're attending a function and they have a duty in that function business-wise? Can you discuss some of those issues?
Yes. This is a very complex area, but basically there's a rule. It's 274M4, I believe. It's right in the statute that gives a special rule for spouses and family members of employees of a company where there's entertainment costs associated with that. And it makes it very hard under that rule. The test is that the spouse has to be an employee of the company, that they have to be on the business of the company, and that the costs would have to be deductible under some other, such as 162 or even 132, if the spouse incurred the expense themselves. And so it becomes very difficult because of that 274M4, I believe it is, to characterize a spouse's presence on board the aircraft, even if it's a business flight, for anything other than business. So for example, if a company executive is flying to a company function where spouses are expected to attend so that they're knowledgeable and can meet and talk to other spouses or customer spouses, I mean, that's considered good business, but the IRS doesn't really recognize that for these entertainment use rules.
I was just curious on that last slide you have up there.
Yes.
Is that a hint? No.
No.
That one. That we really ought to just have them all fly commercial?
No, that was not a hint.
We call those Part 125 size aircraft.
Exactly.
Any other questions for Joanne? If not, Joanne. Oh, one more. Final question.
Mike can answer that one.
Question was, will this presentation be posted on the website? The answer is yes. It'll be in PDF format. Joanne has also provided two other attachments that will PDF. It'll be posted sometime probably next week. And we've also done a podcast of this, so the audio recording is there. So it will live in perpetuity on our website for you to download and listen to.
And just to talk a little bit about the other two materials, I do have an article kind of explaining Notice 2005-45 in a little bit more detail, and then the second article compares the FAA rules to the IRS rules to the SEC rules.
This obviously is an area that's evolving, changing. When the IRS put out the regulations, please watch the NBA weekly update, which we email out to subscribers every Monday evening. If you go to nba.org, there's a place to subscribe to the update if you're not already subscribed. When these regs are out, it'll be a big deal. We will file comments with the IRS on that. Joanne will be intricately involved in that process for us. And we encourage everybody to stay tuned, engaged. We'll have some educational seminars on this as well when we know more information from the IRS. Thank you very much for your attendance. Joanne, thank you.
Thank you.